Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, a very special conversation with Lynn Stewart. Friday, April 25th, in the courtroom in New York, three detectives were found not guilty on all charges in the shooting death of Sean Bell, who died in Queens, in Jamaica, Queens, on November 25th, 2006, in a hail of 50 police bullets, 31 of which came from one policeman alone. What happened? Detective Michael Oliver, who fired 31 bullets the night of the shooting, faced manslaughter charges. In fact, there were eight counts, five felonies, three misdemeanor charges. But Justice Arthur J. Cooperman said that Oliver had made a fair and just decision. Is this alone that a judge lets off policemen in a mass shooting of someone in New York? No, it isn't. Killed or injured by the police was an article in the New York Times on April 26th. Eleanor Bumpers, October 1984, shot and killed by a police officer. Abner Louima, August 1997. He was caught up in a street brawl and arrested. Officer Justin Volpe tortured him with a broomstick in the restroom at the 70th Precinct Station House. One of the rare cases. Mr. Volpe pleaded guilty. There was no other choice. There was so much evidence against him. But other cases, such as Antoine Reed, who was shot and wounded by an off-duty police officer. Officer Meyer was cleared of all criminal charges by the judge who presided in his non-jury trial. Just as in the case of Sean Bell, there was a non-jury trial. Amadou Diallo, February 1999, killed by four officers who fired 41 times in the vestibule of his apartment building in the Bronx. After a tense trial, four officers were acquitted of second-degree murder and other charges, fueling protests. The city, in a palliative measure, agreed to pay the family $3 million. These are just a few of the many cases that have taken place in New York. The police shooting in cold blood people, not even with one shot, but in hail of bullets. Today on Taking Aim, we are going to discuss with attorney Lynn Stewart cases such as this, and also the Mamia Abu Jamal case that we've been discussing on Taking Aim over the past few weeks, and most of all, the status of the federal imposition of charges against Lynn Stewart herself. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you, Maya. Very nice to be here, as always, with you guys.
Thank you, Lynn. Lynn, please tell our listeners about the current status of your appeal and the events surrounding it and the buildup of support, which has been ongoing, and we want to encourage even more so.
Yes, well, we are in the waiting stage. You wait and wait and wait some more. It is completely whenever the judges, and they can be, of course, very aristocratic and not make a decision until they're good and ready to make a decision. So we're waiting. Just in the Mumia case, you know, they waited from May when he had oral argument till the following March before they came down with a decision. And we're assuming the same for any of the BAI listeners, and I know there are only a few who don't know what we're talking about. I am the lawyer who represented blind Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, and at a later date was hauled in by the federal government accused of aiding terrorism for doing the work which I believe any lawyer should do for a client. I was convicted of aiding terrorism. That case is now on appeal, and it is that decision that we're waiting for. So we don't know when it will be. It's a little nerve-wracking, mm-hmm. as you can imagine. I think when my lawyer's office called and got Ralph in the shower and and he almost fell out of the shower. He thought, this is it, this is the moment, but it wasn't. It was something else.
And, Glenn, the federal prosecutors are trying to get you incarcerated and buried alive, basically, for 30 years. They're not satisfied with the judge's decision after the conviction of 24 months.
No, they basically, and it's 28 months. I'm counting. I keep track of these things.
Right. 2 years and 4 months. 28.
Yes. They went up on appeal and said that this was a slap on the wrist. It was an insult, and that the real sentence should be 30 years. They basically said that the 30-year sentence was based on all their calculations, the calculations of the probation department, all the terrorist enhancements. Be that as it may, they found an ally, a quick ally on this panel that heard the case on appeal in the cousin of George Bush, one Judge Walker, who has all the genetic qualities that seem to run in that family. It was tremendously arrogant. The lawyers would correct him. They would say, but Judge, this is how that, this is the facts. And he would go on as if they had not spoken at all. And he, of course, was outraged by the sentence. It should be at least 12 or 15 years. This is serious, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, so, you know, parenthetically, Lynn, one of the Bush cousins who was also a Walker was one of those who was involved in overseeing the security at the World Trade Center at the time that they were shutting it down nominally for electrical work.
Mm-hmm.
Just when we have basically surmised that the explosives were planted. So Walker and the Bush family are certainly on target when it comes to terror, since they are the authors par excellence.
Well, I'd like to think, of course, in my own semi-egotistical way, that they know I'm an enemy. And that's a good thing to be with these people. You want to be their enemy.
Yes.
I'd like to start off by saying here that we're in the studio. We're actually in the WBAI studios in New York at 120 Wall Street. We want to say hello to each and every one of you in the tri-state area, and particularly those who can come see us. And we're going to be at two events. One tomorrow night, Wednesday, there is a rally for the ballot initiative, the 9/11 ballot initiative, and that's going to take place at St. Mark's Church, and the doors open at 6:30, and St. Mark's Church is at 2nd Avenue and 10th Street. So please come. Ralph and I are going to be speaking.
And Lynn is speaking.
And Lynn. About to continue, and Lynn is speaking, and there will be some of the people from the 9/11 families and many more. So please join us. And the ballot initiative, as Taking Aim listeners know, is the initiative to get on the New York City ballot. It's a petition drive now to have on the ballot a measure that will require an independent 9/11 investigation. And Ralph is one of the people involved in the overall investigating committee to set this up. So please come tomorrow, Wednesday, St. Mark's Church, doors open at 6:30. And Thursday, May Day, a very important day throughout the world, and particularly here in New York, there's going to be a wonderful potluck event, rally, dinner, and Lynn at that time will give a further update about her case. Lynn, tell us where it's going to be Thursday, and please join us Thursday as well as Wednesday.
Well, we're hoping everybody will go to the big May Day rally in Union Square, the great traditional, where they used to get 100,000 people. I hope they'll get 10,000 this time. And they will march down to Federal Plaza, and then we have urged everybody to come up and spend the evening with the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee. And basically, we're going to have potluck supper. That means everybody brings some kind of dish or dessert or drink or what have you. And we all share, very communal, which is, of course, to my liking. And then we're going to have some fabulous entertainment. This is all going to take place at the Community Church at 35th and Park, a well-known venue to WBAI listeners. one of the most spectacular pieces of entertainment will be Christine Pointer Bonds, who happens to be Ralph Pointer's daughter, who is a very talented gospel singer and who gave it up to have some kids and be a worker. And we also are going to have and I pronounce this probably not right, a woman named Xmara, who does a one-woman show of Fannie Lou Hamer, an all-time favorite of mine and Ralph's, and we are so looking forward to both of those. And we have our grannies, and we're having Eli Smith, and we're having, of course, our all-time Brooklyn guys. That's Fast Eddie and Professor Louie, who will be rapping to us. So it ought to be very fun, very enjoyable. That starts at about 5:30 or 6. 6, really. We probably won't get set up till 6. And then it has to be over by 9:30 so everybody can get up and go to work the next day.
Okay, great. So we have Wednesday and April 30th at St. Mark's Church, and then a grand march for May Day, followed by, after work, everyone show up at the church, the
Community Church, 35th and Park,
for a wonderful potluck supper and an evening of political entertainment.
And I forgot one thing, Maya. Lynn will be baking pies, which will be raffled off. So, you know, this is really like if you've ever gone to a church supper, this is really the same thing.
Great. While we're mentioning May Day, I want to just alert our listeners to an important May Day event, namely the shutting down of the West Coast by the Longshore Workers Union. And this is a major development, brothers and sisters, because Local 10 has taken the initiative and the longshore workers are going to shut down the coast in opposition to the war in Iraq. And the maritime employers are going berserk here because this is a political act. It's not on a holiday. And, of course, May Day for them is certainly no holiday. You can be sure of that, the maritime employers. But the point being that this is a significant act, rank-and-file act, of militant labor in opposition to the war and to imperialism that is on target for May 1st. And we want to alert all our listeners to that and to the solidarity events that May Day entails for this historic action.
Lynn, you have spent a lifetime defending the oppressed, and particularly here in New York. And I wanted to get your comments on the Sean Bell decision.
Yeah. Well, I think everyone was in shock, although then 5 minutes later saying to yourself, how can I be in shock? This has happened so many times. And it happens, you know, it happens when the judge acquits the cops, and it happens when the cops themselves, something happens to them, and someone gets sent to jail and is never eligible for parole. It really, to me, is the epitome of the police state that at least the black community lives with every moment of every day. We in the white communities, we don't see it, quite not so much in our faces. But this is the reality. If you have a teenage child and you live and you're from Bed-Stuy, you really don't know whether he's coming home that night. You really have no idea. And to me, this is what we have to rally against. And it can't just be, you know, praying after the verdict. I'm sorry. And, of course, my partner, Ralph Pointer, is even more pointed about it and says nobody ever got free by singing and dancing, even though we do it better than anybody. But he says, you know, this is something that needs a strategic response. It is not going to be found within the system, as far as I can see. It's not going to be found by special prosecutors. It is just appalling. And you named a few, Maya. We could spend the whole program going through all the cases there are. Including one, the Rosarios, who lost their son and their nephew in what was called a justifiable homicide. It turned out when the investigation was done, they had both been shot at point blank in the back. and yet this was called a justifiable homicide by the police, and they've never been able. It made one thing, it made two great political fighters out of the parents of this young man, and that seems to be what happens, but it's a terrible way to get people aroused and able to fight back.
And by justifiable homicide, do they mean, as in some of the cases that I had reviewed that were in the New York Times, what they had said is that the police had reason to believe that somebody might have a gun.
Yeah. It's really self-defense is what we're talking about. That case that I just mentioned, the Rosarios, mm-hmm. and a great film was made of that called Justifiable Homicide, including a clip from himself, Giuliani, insulting this mother on the phone. She called and she says, I don't know why the investigation isn't reopened. We have new evidence. And Giuliani replied, why didn't you raise your son better? Why wasn't he raised so that he would have respect for the police and he wouldn't have been killed then? I mean, it was just the most appalling thing I think I ever heard.
Mm-hmm.
But it really, what we're talking about here is justifiable homicide means that a grand jury didn't even get to the point of bringing a case. They're saying, we've heard it, it's justifiable, all charges dropped at this early stage. What happened with the fellows out in Queens, these murderers out in Queens, was that the judge found self-defense, justification, and
he reloads in the middle of the fusillade. He fires over 31 times, reloading at the time against an unarmed man, but it's justifiable homicide.
Exactly right.
Lynn, could you explain? I was confused by the fact that there wasn't a jury.
Yeah, a lot of people are. Well, it's New York law, and it works for people, and it works against people. It's an absolute right of a defendant to go to trial without a jury, to elect to only present the case to a judge. Now, this is because some folks or some people I have represented feel that a jury, once they heard, say, of their criminal record, or they were described as a prostitute, they would not get a fair trial from a jury. A jury would be so overwhelmed by just the personage that they would not hear the facts. Of course, this is standing it on its head. This is saying, I don't want a jury to hear these facts. I'm sure a jury would convict me, and I don't want to go to a jury. And I know that this judge, and I'm going to absolutely, you know, one of the things that really got me also was the district attorney, Richard Brown, announced that Judge Cooperman is a great jurist. And I turned to Ralph, and I said, the two of them are the biggest political hack appointments that you've ever seen, and they're both in the same league. And you can just see, here's this district attorney currying favor, just as he did during the trial. The fact that they introduced these confessions, which couldn't be cross-examined, which just go in as evidence.
But after all, then, when we really look at this, you know, we have here an article in the New York Times, inmate count in U.S. dwarfs other nations. The United States is less than 5% of the world's population, but a quarter of the world's prisoners, leads the world in producing prisoners. This is the New York Times, April 23rd, a reflection of a recent and now distinctively American approach to crime and punishment. Americans are locked up for crimes from bad checks to drugs that would rarely produce a prison sentence in another country, and they are kept incarcerated far longer than prison. This is the prison house of nations, in essence, and the police function as an occupying army. When I think back on some of the aspects of Mumia, I mean, considering that the assistant prosecutor, we have a videotape of him, which we presented to the Justice Department in the year 2000, in which he's instructing prosecutors on how to keep blacks off the jury, and if they're already on the jury, how to get them removed from the jury. And then he violates federal law, but you'll find a way. And he begins to delineate, you know, they all got problems with the law, they all got this, that, the other. You just, you know, it's in your face. Now we have a circumstance in which the man who has actually structured the call for the execution of Mia Abu Jamal is sitting on the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. I believe he was actually Chief Justice at the time, and he's asked to recuse himself when he's hearing the appeal on the death sentence that he himself has crafted. He declines to recuse himself on the grounds that all members of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court are either members of the Philadelphia Order of Police or paid by them. and if he were to recuse himself, why, he said there would be nobody left on the court. We were suggesting to the head of the criminal division of the Justice Department that would be a nice beginning, followed by indictments of these so-called arbiters of justice, but... After all, what are we looking at here? There is no system that adjudicates anything but the means of railroading people, killing them in cold blood, occupying the communities like a foreign occupying army, and the consequences are in what we see daily.
You know, Ralph, for many years we always said we used to use the frame... last hired, first fired. The new rubric, it seems to me, should be first failed, then jailed. This is what happens to the youth in the black community. They're failed in schools. They find themselves completely useless. They go out on the street. They commit economic crimes, as far as I'm concerned, and they end up in the prison system. They get out. They can't go back home and live at home because, you know, they're precluded from living in public housing. Mm-hmm. They can't go to school. They're not allowed to go to school. They're not allowed. They're not eligible for grants. So what do? They have to go back to the life of crime. And it's endless, and it's calculated. And I used to say to my clients who were, you know, acting like it was some mistake that they had been arrested, I would say, it's a big mistake. But let me tell you something. You were programmed for this. You were programmed for it the moment you were born. You were programmed all through school and finally when the authorities caught up with you. I'm finding one thing I thought we ought to maybe talk about.
Yes.
The notion that was put out, I think, by some of the media that there was no community reaction because the cops, two of them, were black.
The Sean Bell case?
In the Sean Bell case, yes. I'm sorry. I should have introduced it better. You know, that somehow or other this took it out of the Rodney mm-hmm. King-type situation where there was a reaction, to say the least. And it is true. There is no reaction. Basically, there was a march, which didn't get any publicity, but it was 500 people. It wasn't like... barricades and flames and overturned trucks and cars. It was basically a fairly orderly process. I wanted to talk a little bit about whether or not the race of the police makes this difference.
I think that's a good subject because the police commissioner himself had enough of a force available because he anticipated a reaction after the verdict.
Yeah.
But after all, one of the Lynn.
Go ahead, Ralph.
I wanted to say that, look, let's be clear about this. The ruling class is very conscious of the importance of having black bourgeois faces in high places. When they wanted to bomb MOVE, they didn't do it under the watch of Frank Rizzo. By the way, Frank Rizzo at a press conference when Mumia Abu Jamal, having been responsible almost individually, single-handedly, for nearly 300 cases of people who had been framed and who had to be ordered released, who had in fact targeted the various victims of police frame-ups and set-ups and so on, and at a press conference, Frank Rizzo looked at Mumia Abu Jamal, who's a member of the journalist...
The black journalist.
Black journalist, and he says to him... I hope it happens on my watch. In fact, I'm determined that it will. But he says, we're going to get you. He says, we're going to deal with you. This is the mayor of Philadelphia at a public press conference calling out that he is going to deal with Mumia Abu Jamal, but they waited until they had Wilson Good, a liberal black Democrat, as the mayor of Philadelphia before they torched the MOVE community and incinerated people and bombed a whole section of Philadelphia. And anticipating that because they have a black face in a high place, they can mute, contain, deflect, or in some way control the necessary response on the part of the oppressed. Without mobilization and without resistance, there's never going to be an end to this.
But that's why, our work is important, our work, we of the left, to make the community aware that black is not always beautiful if it is doing the work of the man. And that includes Al Sharpton, that includes Dave Dellums, it includes all these folks that are here to pacify. There is nobody saying, we've had enough of this, let's take this down to City Hall, and if we don't get an answer, nobody raising any kind of militant line whatsoever. Nobody suggesting that perhaps the community should be under its own control rather than under the control of outsiders all the time. The rallying cries of the 60s need to come back, and one of the things that I think is very important is, you know, there has never been a freedom movement that ever got free without recognizing the traitors within. That in pointing them out and recognizing them for the content and the quality of their leadership or lack thereof. And until the black community does this, it's not going to go anywhere. It's going to be more killings, more people out there just like this.
Yes, this is a question that not only I think affects the most oppressed sector of the class, of the working class, but the working class at large. Without independent political leadership, without political organization, without the will to struggle, there's no way to contain, let alone remove this system. I'm thinking, for example, when we had the recent example of Tarif. When Michael Tarif Warren was brutalized at the police station, when his wife Yvonne was punched out, weighing all of 98 pounds because they witnessed a black youngster being beaten to the ground with sticks by a gang of cops, the city should have been shut down. This is not just a question of a police station in Bedford-Stuyvesant. This is the police chief Kelly. This is the mayor Bloomberg. This is not a random rogue operation. This is the standard procedure that flows from the criminalization of poverty, from the targeting of a victim sector of the class forever being targeted in this fashion. We need to organize resistance, and when these events happen, the Bell case is a beautiful example to wit. The response should be shut the city down. Black workers are in transportation, they're in communication, they're at the heart of production in this city, and it's not a question of the black working class on its own. The whole aspect of struggle has to be, as you say, at the heart of response to this police state apparatus and the criminalization of poverty.
I can tell you, we did a demo outside the police station in Jamaica. And rather than just standing on the sidewalk and chanting, we actually confronted the passerbys in cars. They were sort of stuck in traffic there anyway, but they couldn't get away. But this is a black community. And the response was overwhelming. You know, we were saying, blow your horn if you want justice for Sean Bell. This is back when this first occurred. Mm-hmm. And the people responded. They were into it. Even one funny thing, I mean, a bus driver, he was sitting straight up. He didn't want to respond. And everyone on the bus was yelling, blow your horn, till he finally did. But I'm saying it's there. It needs to be tapped.
Mm. We will pause now for a brief station identification.
WBAI, 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 New York, New York, New York, New York, WBAI.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We're having a very special conversation today in the WBAI studio with Lynn Stewart. Welcome back, Lynn.
Thank you, Maya. My pleasure.
You know, Lynn, I want to come back to your own case for the the moment now, because our listeners need to be reminded and to understand that you were enfolded within the charges, namely because you're representing a person falsely accused, and particularly with the rubric of terror, terror, terror. You then become, in fact, charged with that for which you are defending your falsely accused client. If there isn't a more fundamental destruction of the process, the due process, I don't know what it can be. And more to the point, they fathered upon Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman the so-called Landmarks case, as well as the responsibility for the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, when the record is replete with the evidence of the role of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the orchestration and coordination and implementation of that that very event. So, and I'm reminded, too, Lynn, I just want to mention this, that at one point Judge Mukasey, who is now the Attorney General of the United States, when confronted by the fact that it is the Federal Bureau of Investigation and operatives thereof who provided the explosives employed in the World Trade Center, made the memorable comment, "Just think how fortunate it was that the government provided the explosives. Had it been the accused, how much more damaging would the explosives have been?" If this, I mean, this is cloud cuckoo land, but this is, and that is the heart of the absurdity of the and the gravamen of the false charges against against you, that they are in the first place charges for which your client was not guilty and innocent. And secondly, the perpetrators are the authorities themselves, the very parties that are engaged in the prosecution. We now understand why they are determined to put you away for 30 years. So, brothers and sisters, this is the very epitome of the struggle for our liberation, because Lynn Stewart's case expresses exactly the architecture of the fascist state that is embodied in the treatment of the falsely accused as if they are to be buried alive with no alternative.
Ralph, we should be clear. Lynn is convicted of providing material support when, in fact, Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman has been buried alive in life imprisonment, and Lynn is visiting him in prison. And she is his attorney, and is at the time, and the main purpose here, as I see it, is to prevent anyone from having a true defense, to have a representative, an advocate. And Lynn is a specific target here because she is somebody who has spent a lifetime defending the oppressed.
Just to say this, though, this is the terrorizing of the people of the United States. This is the actual perpetrators of state terror, demonstrating that there is nothing to which they will not resort in their maniacal campaign to subjugate our population, because this is a system in crisis. The crisis is all around us. The crisis is in permanent war. The crisis is in Hillary Clinton declaring that she will incinerate Iran. The crisis is in Obama calling for preemptive strikes on Tehran and Afghanistan. The crisis is in a system that is addicted to permanent war while it is in process of decomposition. $514 trillion in derivatives on the part of Bear Stearns, while the infrastructure of our society is cannibalized and people are in free fall. Hunger is and immiseration is no wonder they are required to terrorize us and to put us behind bars on pretexts at every opportunity. That's what this case represents.
I think this is true, Ralph, and it carries out in every detail. I mean, you know, my case, of course, was perhaps at the time of 9-1-1, 6 months later, brought. But, you know, this we see it over and over again. Samuel Aryan, who has been jailed, he was acquitted. They made a deal, end quote, with the government that he would be deported if he pled guilty. There would be no further grand jury action. And what happened? He pled guilty, and he was kept. and he was subpoenaed. And he was subpoenaed in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is, if we were going to talk about a den of iniquity, that Eastern District is it. They're all hand-picked judges. They're right there at CIA headquarters. They're all very, very conservative. It's also the Judge Brinker in the Massawi case, who actually did not allow the client to see the material that his lawyers would have relied on to go to trial. Massawi, who is supposedly the 20th bomber, is a person who pled guilty, and his lawyers were not permitted to tell him what information they had been given that they would have encouraged him to go to trial. So this erosion continues. It may start. I may be the poster girl, and they may never have expected me to stand up to them and say, you know, don't look at me and say, what did she do wrong? Look at them and say, what were they doing there? What were they doing wrong listening in to privileged attorney-client conversation? You know, let's look at this. Let's look at the torture my client was undergoing. Mm-hmm. Didn't recognize it at the time. We weren't so aware at that point of the mental head games this government engages in. Now I see it so clearly. They were torturing him.
Yes, and by the way, I want to mention, Lynn, with respect to Massawi. Do you know that Massawi came into court when he was defending himself, and it was a public arena, and journalists and others were able to be present, and Massawi said, look, I was under the direction of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This was something that we were put up to do, and I want to present evidence. He says, In fact, I would be willing to appear before Congress and present chapter and verse. And the BBC gave a full report on this extraordinary declaration in court by Massawi. And that same day, the judge banned any further open hearings, declared that all further proceedings would be in camera, and then shut down Massawi's right to defend himself, just as they had done with Mumia. So I think what we see here at every conjuncture at which this apparatus of the state terror is picking off people and fathering upon us this fiction of this terror menace to state capitalism, that the hand of the state is revealed for the authorship of the very events they're imputing to victim others. But in particular with respect, Lynn, to your case, after all, I mean, your trial was an absolute caricature in which the newspaper clippings and the research that was in your office to prepare the defense of your client is seized and invoked as evidence because you're taking clippings and reading news reports about charges of terrorism. That means that you're collecting information that shows your own predisposition to support terrorism. If this isn't the essence of a kangaroo court, I don't know what is. And I just wondered, Lynn, if you could explain for the listeners the particulars of the grounds of appeal, the challenge to the premise of your conviction that is about to be adjudicated.
Well, for me, the main premises, of course, is the First Amendment, that this was basically a lawyer making a press release. It was my client's words or my words, allegedly protected by the First Amendment, in order to be run afoul of that protection, in order to be declined, you have to be very imminent to danger. It has to be right there. You're saying, light the fire and blow it up, you know? This was so far away, as my lawyer told the court, this was so far away from anything happening. And actually, John Ashcroft, on the day of my arrest, was, of course, asked by the press, so she made the press release, and what happened? And he said, well, nothing happened. And that's right, nothing happened. So one of our big grounds for appeal is we were protected by the First Amendment, and they can't prosecute based on words alone, which is what this is. We also have a number of other items having to do with the right to an attorney, and including the attorney-client privilege conversations, which were seized. It is a siege. They went to my office. They went through it. They were there all day from 9 in the morning till 6 at night. They took the hard drives out of the computers. That means every letter that I ever wrote, whether it was to Mumia, whether it was to Sammy the Bull Gravano, whether it was to the Sheikh, they have them all. They also went through all the files at the office, and they did their usual in trial. The biggest thing was, they understand how the psyche works, and if you make people afraid enough, just showing them the symbol that they are afraid of invokes the fear all over again. So we understand from a news report in, of all things, the Star-Ledger in New Jersey, that it is part of the kit and caboodle of the U.S. attorneys now that if they're trying a terror case, they've got to get bin Laden into it somehow, whether he's in it or not in it. So in our case, they had found videotapes of a conference that was held in the late 80s and found it in my co-defendant's basement. And they showed these videotapes to show knowledge. Of course, the judge said, and he said it 800 times, this is not evidence against Miss Stewart. This is evidence against co-defendant. And you may disregard it completely where it has to do with her.
Here's a nice little irony about that.
Lynn, how is it even evidence against your co-defendant?
Well, their theory was, and the judge bought it, was that it showed you have to prove knowledge and you have to prove intent. If we're intending to help a terrorist, we have to know that he is indeed a terrorist. And part of that proof was this conference that was held in which Osama, at that point, nobody knew his name even, I don't think, was calling for the release of Sheikh Omar. So for that incremental, and we said, but this is hardly of a weight compared with, and I tell you, Ralph and Maya, they showed this on a screen that was like 20 by 20. It just dominated the entire courtroom. You just felt like Osama was leaning over.
Guess what? In the time frame in question, Osama bin Laden was employed by the Central Intelligence Agency. I have to tell you that when we used to report that the CIA had given Osama bin Laden and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar approximately $6 billion, and at one point in time I was speaking to the head of the ISI, Pakistani head of the ISI, General Gul Hamid, and I was asking him how much money was involved actually in orchestrating this whole campaign in Afghanistan and in the republics of the, and he said $50 billion, my dear sir. So the
it was the CIA and also British intelligence that funded Osama bin Laden and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar to set up the Mujahideen movement, which would then go against the.
You know, I may have misspoke the date here because it definitely was a rally. Because the Sheikh was in jail. Mm-hmm. And, of course, he wasn't in jail until after 93 or 94. So it definitely, I did misspeak the date. But the facts are absolutely true. And they also had a picture of the Sheikh and bin Laden in Afghanistan in the days of which you're talking about, of course, to prove.
Well, Lynn, for the record, I mean, not only is Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman not involved in anything to do with the bombing of the World Trade Center, let alone the Landmarks case, but in the days that Sheikh Omar was in beginning his movement of opposition in Egypt, he had support, as did bin Laden, in Operation Cyclone from the Central Intelligence Agency. So you see, these are people who are being set up, used and abused, and they are demonized because they're handy as boogeymen, essentially, to terrorize the population. They have nothing to do with these crimes of the rulers. They are, in fact, just held out as symbols to be utilized in order to terrorize the population without a scintilla of evidence.
And also in Egypt, I think the history is pretty clear. that Sadat utilized the Sheikh and his movement, his Islamist movement, to get rid of any lingering Nasserites or left wing, to just eliminate them, because of course, in within the Islamist thing, they were not tolerated. So it, of course, came back to haunt him ultimately. But
well, that's what happens when you know you're doing whatever your own conscious intent, the bidding of the imperial master. Their objectives are not yours. Theirs to use and abuse and to oppress all of us. But Lynn, you know, not merely that, but here they were introducing Osama bin Laden into a courtroom. There isn't a scintilla of evidence to associate Osama bin Laden with the bombing of the World Trade Center. The videotapes are scissors and paste jobs to the last one. This is documented. And the only actual interview record statements, of which there have been six by Osama bin Laden on record, are those in which he disavows involvement with the attacks on the World Trade Center, which he calls unappreciable events involving the attacking of citizens, whether they men, women, or children. He says, my quarrel is not with the population of the United States. It's with those who need budgets for military and intelligence, who despoil our countries, who occupy our countries, who support the Zionist state to once again create refugees and so on. It's, you don't have to romanticize Osama bin Laden to understand that he is a very specific, elaborated denouncer of those events as not his own. And furthermore, he has almost no political incentive, since if the assumption being made is that he is rallying his support around these circumstances, these events, to repudiate them, disavow them as a method of struggle. And the record about his presumptive involvement in the events of 9/11, let alone the collateral false flag operations, is without any basis whatsoever. So it's doubly duplicitous in the way in which it was deployed in your trial.
I think this is a good point to bring up again, that we're here in the studio in New York, and that the next 2 days we have wonderful events where we would like to share with you and be with you. One is tomorrow, Wednesday, April 30th. Doors opening at 6:30 at St. Mark's Church for a rally, and Ralph and I will be making extended presentations, and Lynn Stewart is going to be speaking, and there are many other people. Please join the New York 9/11 Truth Movement at this important petition drive rally, and this refers to the ballot measure that we're trying to get on the ballot in New York for a really independent investigation, a citizen's investigation of the events of 9/11, where the truth comes out, not the whitewash that has been imposed upon the people of the United States by the administration, by the rulers of this country. So that is on Wednesday. Doors open again at 6:30. And then on Thursday, May Day, the grand celebration marches in earlier in the day, and then in the evening, Lynn, could you tell us about the wonderful potluck?
And I just want to say that we'll all be at St. Mark's, 2nd Avenue and 10th Street, very centrally located, and a real a place of great historical significance. If you've been listening at all here today, you know why this investigation, this independent investigation, is so important, that the 911 Commission was another part of the cover-up rather than being something that was going to illuminate anything for us. The Wednesday night thing is a potluck supper. That means everybody brings a dish and we all eat each other's good food, and it's a more relaxed evening. Ralph and Meyer are going to join us, and I'm making my special tabbouleh for them. And it's at the community church at 35th and Park Avenue. It will start. The food will probably begin being served at 6, and the entertainment will start at 6:30. So we hope to see everyone there just to help me through this terrible waiting time, which is probably the most annoying and nerve-wracking thing you can undergo. You wake up in the morning and you say, what's wrong? And you say, I'm still waiting for that decision.
That's a harrowing experience to have hanging over everyone's head, being buried alive. The government seeking 30 years in a frame-up of enormous magnitude.
Which brings us back to organizing again, because, Lynn, as you know, judges do respond to pressure, social pressure. And we saw this over and again, particularly at the level of the Supreme Court, where, for instance, with the abortion laws, if there hadn't been a mass movement of women, we wouldn't have been able to have the Supreme Court decision, which once the mass movement died out, you have the whittling away, state by state in particular, of the woman's right to choose. And then we have this again, as you mentioned earlier, with the police license to kill, or a judge's, federal prosecutor's license to come against you as an attorney. So the importance of organizing and all of us gathering, speaking to each other and coming up with actions that we can take and organizations that we can develop is extremely significant. So we hope to see you Wednesday and Thursday. Actually, we expect to see you. We look forward to seeing you Wednesday and Thursday of
this
week.
Yes, we've taken some hard hits in the last weeks or two. The Mumia decision was a terrible, terrible disappointment and moved him that much closer to also to death penalty or life in prison. That's what he's facing now.
Yes,
so we need to hang on to each other and get going.
Because we are dealing essentially with a state that knows no limits. I mean, Mumia Abu-Jamal, you have the subordinating of perjury as the heart of that case. The so-called prosecution witnesses have all disavowed. The witnesses who have actually come forward, such as Arnold Beverly, who have actually delineated exactly how Faulkner was killed. This is the policeman Daniel Faulkner. You have the FBI record that Faulkner was a whistleblower on the corrupt cops and that the cops had organized his being taken out. These are the circumstances. I want to mention one particular thing here, brothers and sisters, because you see, the trial of Lynn Stewart, the conviction of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, the framing of Mumia Abu-Jamal, the exoneration of the murderers of Bell, this is part of a process. It's a process of decomposition of a state system that is determined to subjugate its population. FBI deputizes business. 23,000 representatives of private industry are working for the Department of Homeland Security. The members of this rapidly growing organization, InfraGuard, receive secret warnings of terror threats from the authorities. InfraGuard is a child of the FBI, says Michael Hirschman, the chairman of the InfraGuard National Members Alliance and CEO of the Fairfax Group. And what we are talking about, brothers and sisters, is the authorization on the part of the Federal Bureau of Investigation of a private apparatus of brown shirts that can shoot on sight with impunity. You're talking about the color of authority. It's not only going to be cops, and don't forget that the people who shot down Bell were in plain clothes, but the FBI is now deputizing, and they acknowledge 23,000. And chapters are being formed around the United States, brothers and sisters. Let's be clear here. Lynn Stewart's case embraces the reality that we are all targeted for subjugation and for worse. This is a question of fighting back. This is a question of removing the system as it decomposes. We have to take the offensive and build a struggle movement that will take power from these people once and for all. Those are the stakes, nothing short of that.
And we hope to see you, look forward to seeing you Wednesday, April 30th at St. Mark's Church. Doors open at 6:30. And again on May Day at the Community Church at
35th and Park Avenue. A very glamorous address for a church that has really dedicated itself to the people. So we're utilizing their facilities.
So all out in support of Lynn Stewart. We look forward to seeing you on May 1st. That's the right day for the right celebration, brothers and sisters.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, A Conversation with Lynn Stewart, was recorded in the WBAI studios on Tuesday, April 29th, 2008.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
Mayday 2008. Stagnant wages if you have a job at all. What? No health care?